I reached over to show it to him. He grabbed my wrist.
"Don't ever try to steal from me,"
he whispered. "What are you talking about?" I said, trying to pull away. His grip tightened.
"You saw my papers."
"No, I didn't. Stop. You're hurting me."
"You know something about me. This wound."
His voice was weak, but carried concern. Or was it delirium? He mumbled for a while and then said,
"Tell me something about you."
He released his grip slightly. "You want to know something about me?" I asked. I stared at his tired face. He waited, eyelids beginning to droop. They fluttered closed, and his fingers softly released my wrist. I watched him breathe for a while, his identity papers still tucked under his torso. He wanted to know something about me. I leaned over and put my mouth to his ear. It was barely a whisper.
"I'm a murderer."
Florian. Thoughts of the nurse girl followed me through sleep and lingered after I awoke. Did I dream that I spoke with her? It made me angry. With each day that passed, the threat mounted. Had they made the discovery in Königsberg yet? I couldn't let a pretty girl sidetrack me. The barn was still dark, hollow with the emptiness of the displaced people it housed. My wristwatch said it was approaching 4 a.m. I pulled myself to a sitting position, gritting my teeth to fight the pain. My pack was untouched, my papers still beneath me. I returned the documents to my jacket and got to my feet. I took a couple of steps toward the barn door, and the blind girl sat up, her milky eyes blinking. The nurse slept next to her, her suitcase open, pretty brown hair scalloped around her face. What did she say her name was? No, it didn't matter. She was ugly. That's what I told myself. I knelt and rummaged through the nurse's suitcase. The blind girl's nose rose toward the roof. She rotated her head and stared straight at me. What could she see? Were her eyes frosted over like an icy window, allowing light and dark to filter through? Or was her world curtained black? My hands silently sifted through the nurse's belongings. What was I doing? This girl had possibly saved me. Saved me for a single drag of a cigarette. I told myself it wasn't stealing. It was protection. I sorted through clothes, a medical book, the fork she had eaten the potato with, and then I pulled out something unexpected. I looked at the nurse's loose brown curls for a moment, slipped the item into my jacket pocket, and left. There were Russians in the woods. I knew that already. Most likely scouts or drifters who had been separated from their unit. I could handle one soldier. But how long before full troops swarmed the area? Originally, I'd had 2 weeks to get to the port. That was the plan. I'd get on a ship, sail to the west, and the mission would be accomplished. Once outside the barn, I reorganized my pack. I saw the letter with my identity card and couldn't brush it from my mind. Dr. Lange. Dr. Lange was the director of the museum in Königsberg. He had hired me as a restoration apprentice, trained me, even sent me to the best school. I looked up to him and wrote detailed letters from the institute, sharing all of my thoughts on art and philosophy. Dr. Lange claimed I was brilliant. He said that my talents would provide Germany with a great service, one that would bring the Führer's dream of a national art museum in his hometown of Linz to fruition. Then Dr. Lange introduced me to Gauleiter Erich Koch. Koch was the leader of the regional branch of the Nazi Party. He was also a monster. When the belted crates of art started arriving at the museum, Dr. Lange's enthusiasm was infectious. Some pieces made him weep. At times I had to steady him as a new addition was unveiled. He would put me to work immediately when each crate arrived. Sometimes I'd work through the night on a restoration, so Dr. Langa could report to Kalk the very next day. I went without sleep, without eating, even missed my father's birthday to complete the tasks and please Dr. Langa. "We make a great team, don't we, Florian?" he would say, grinning. One morning, Dr. Langa sent me searching for a roll of misplaced twine. While looking, I found all of my letters to him from the Institute, carelessly thrown in a bottom drawer with ink and supplies. My letters were unopened. He hadn't even cared enough to read them. A voice rose behind me in the dark, pulling me from my thoughts. I grasped my pistol and reeled around.
"Wait, please!"
The Polish girl, pink and out of breath, ran toward me in the snow.
Amelia. I could not trust the people in the barn. The giant woman recoiled when she learned I was Polish, so I willed my legs to move faster, telling myself that once I told the knight my story, he would understand. He would know what I had done for his country. He would protect me. My stomach complained. Would the hunger ever fade? Retreat in a kind and gentle way, and stop its constant knocking? I couldn't remember not being fearful and hungry, when my stomach didn't feel pulled with yearning. My mental pictures of Lvov seemed to be fading, like a photograph left outside in the sun. Lvov, the city that always smiled. A place of education and culture in Poland. How much of Lvov would survive? The knight's silhouette came into view and inspired me to move faster. I called out, and he turned, gun aimed.
"Wait, please," I said. "I'm coming with you."
He turned away from me, then continued on his path. I followed his fresh tracks in the snow and felt stronger, the January morning air sharp and crisp in my nostrils. I kept walking, following. After several meters, he stopped and turned, furious.
"Go away!"
"No," I protested.
"It's safer for you to stay with the others," he said.
"Safer?" He didn't realize. I was already dead.
Joanna. Mornings held the promise of progress, dangling hope with thoughts of the next stop. We all fantasized of more than a barn. The shoe poet talked of grand manors owned by Junkers, wealthy East Prussian aristocrats. The countryside was dotted with their estates, and we were bound to come upon one. Poet said he had visited one such manor house prior to the war and thought it was close by. We dreamed the wealthy family would take us in, ladle thick soup into porcelain bowls, and let us warm our frozen toes by the fire. Poet walked around the barn, tapping the bottoms of people's feet with his walking stick. The wandering boy followed.
"Time to rise. Feet are strongest in the morning," said the shoemaker.
He arrived in front of me.
"Still in fine shape, those boots. Any blisters?"
"No, poet." I stood up and brushed myself off. "Is everyone ready to go?"
"The German deserter and the runaway Pole are gone," he announced.
They all thought he was a deserter. My mind flashed to him snapping the identity card and letter from my hand. I'm surprised he felt well enough to move on so early.
"His boots were military issue, but modified," said the shoe poet.
He sighed, shaking his round head of white hair.
"This war. Do you realize that young people are fighting on tiny islands in the Pacific Ocean and marching through the deserts of North Africa? We are freezing, and they are dying of heat. So many unfortunate children. The young Polish girl was exhausted. Her feet were swollen, rising like yeast buns in those boots. But sadly, it's probably for the best. We don't want them caught among our group. If my mind still serves as well as my feet, we'll come upon the estate before nightfall. No one will let us in with a deserter and a Pole. Of course it's for the best, said Ava. A deserter and a Pole? I'm sorry, but they'll be dead on the road in a day. Oh my, you're a blister, Ava. A sour little blister.
The shoe poet laughed and shook his walking stick at her.
Alfred. The morning sky draped cold shadows over the dock. Was my beloved Deutschland losing her footing? Was such a thing possible? Lübeck, Köln, Hamburg. Reports said they were all rubble. The U.S. Army 8th Air Force had bombed the harbor a few months prior. More than 100 American planes dropped steel suppositories exploding into Gotenhafen. The ship Stuttgart was hit and sunk. They had bombed before. They would do it again. 3 air raid alerts had been established in a tier of severity. I memorized them. Rain, hail, snow. In the event of attack, I imagined I'd fire back into the air, wildly shaking a fist of ammunition at them. In my mind, I scaled such mountains of combat often. But in the meantime, I employed my keen powers of observation rather than beastly force. The Führer insisted on meticulous record-keeping. I had every intention of proving myself worthy of promotion to documentarian. After all, I was a watchman. Noting and repeating my observations only sharpened my mental catalog. My recitations seemed to bother my fellow sailors, but could I really blame them for being jealous of my archival facilities? I had a secret device. To keep track of the Reich's racial, social, and political enemies, I had put the Führer's list to melody. It was easier to remember when I sang it, similar to a child reciting a lesson in song. It was a rather catchy tune. Communists, Czechoslovaks, Greeks, gypsies, handicapped, homosexuals. Insert breath here. Jews, mentally ill, Negroes, Poles, prostitutes, Russians, Serbs, socialists. Insert breath here. Spanish Republicans, trade unionists, Ukrainians, and... insert breath for big ending here. Yugoslavs. The Yugoslav finale was my favorite. 3 syllabic punches of power. I mentally sang my melody while performing my other duties. A formal operation was in progress at the port, but specific details had not yet been revealed. Conversations were fraught with nerves and fear. I listened carefully. Don't just stand there eavesdropping, Frick. Move! You want to be blown up by a Russian plane? Certainly not. I balanced the stack of blue life jackets and peeked out from the side. Where am I taking these? I asked. The officer pointed to an enormous slate-gray ship that matched the menacing sky. That one, he said. The Wilhelm Gustloff.
Florian.
Leave! Go away!
I was annoyed, angry. Why wouldn't she leave? Walking clearly exhausted her.
I follow far behind. You don't see me,
she said in her broken German. I can't protect you.
Maybe I protect you,
she said, her face earnest. I don't need protection.
Then why you're not taking the road?
She kicked at the snow that had turned to ice overnight.
Road is much faster. More chance of food. Countryside prettier, but takes longer. You don't want to be seen?
She pulled her pink hat farther down over her ears. What I didn't want was to waste time. I turned from her and resumed walking. I heard her speaking Polish, talking to herself. Eventually she would get tired and have to stop. Her weary body wouldn't carry her far. Thoughts of my younger sister pecked at me, and finally I turned. As soon as I stopped, she stopped, lingering to rest against a tree. I reached into my pack and retrieved the Russian soldier's gun. I walked back to her. Take this. If you need to use it, hold it with two hands when you pull the trigger. Do you understand? Now go away. She nodded, but I was certain she didn't understand. The gun looked huge in her knitted glove. I walked away. Was I crazy? Three steps back was a Pole with a Soviet gun, following me, a Prussian carrying enough secrets to blow up the kingdom. My wound cried out, and so did my judgment. If I didn't report to a checkpoint soon, it would all be over.
Joanna. We trudged along the road, the sky gray and heavy. I looked up at the clouds. It's going to snow, said Ingrid, sensing my evaluation. You can feel it? I asked. Sometimes. She nodded, adjusting her grip on the rope tied to the back of the cart. Tell me about them, said Ingrid. The boy and the Polish girl. I have an idea. I want to know if I'm right. It was fascinating that Ingrid could feel what people looked like. She told me that she could sense a person's build, demeanor, sometimes even hair color. But it was the internal qualities that came to her first. The girl was fearful, said Ingrid. Her motions were taut and full of panic. Her breathing was pinched, almost panting. The boy was the opposite. His movement was smooth and lithe, like he was accustomed to moving silently. For days he had been moving with shrapnel the size of a bottle cap inside of him. I thought about his wound and wondered if he still had a fever. What was her name? The frightened girl? Asked Ingrid. Amelia? Yes, that matches, said Ingrid. She tripped over a rock in her path and nearly fell. She clung to the rope and scrambled to regain her balance. I set my hand on her shoulder. This trek was difficult enough for someone with sight. 2 weeks ago, amidst mad chaos at a train station, Ingrid became separated from her aunt. The train departed. Ingrid was not on it. She stood alone on the platform for 2 straight days, shivering, waiting for her aunt to return. The aunt never came back. On the 3rd day, Ingrid asked people for help. They ignored her. Her luggage was stolen. A young girl finally noticed Ingrid and brought her to my attention. Don't feel sorry for me, said Ingrid. I am able to see things, just not the same things you see. So, the girl? She's blonde? Yes, Amelia's fair-haired with braids, blue eyes, and a round face. The young man is fairly tall, has broad shoulders and brown hair that falls in waves. His hair is a bit long. I don't know his name or what city he's from. And his eyes? Asked Ingrid. What color are they? I don't remember. Maybe brown? I don't think so. I think they're gray, said Ingrid. Gray? No, people don't really have gray eyes. The thief does, said Ingrid. I turned to her. You think he's a thief? Ingrid said nothing. The temperature dropped, and the exposed parts of my face began to sting. We had been walking for over 6 hours. Ava complained incessantly. She hated the trek. She hated the cold. She hated the Russians. She hated the war. The shoe poet had promised that today we would find the manor house he had known. I doubted him and warned that he shouldn't get people's hopes up, especially the little one. The wandering boy's spirits were already so low.
Ah, but if I am right, said Poet, you will massage my feet by the fire.
I wasn't sure I wanted to accept that wager.
Amelia. I busied myself on the walk. I looked at the trees and thought of the big stork's nest I had seen on top of the barn. It made me think of Mama. I thought of the warm, sunny days when she would take me to pick mushrooms in the forest. In the forest near Lvov was a beautiful old oak tree with a hollow large enough to sit in. We'd take our baskets to the tree, and I'd scramble into the cavity. Mama would sit with her back against the trunk, legs crossed at the ankles beneath her skirt. You love stories, Amelia. Well, the trees hold hundreds of years of stories, she'd tell me, touching the bark. Think of it. Everything these trees have seen and felt, all of the secrets are inside of them. Do you think the trees remember each and every stork? I'd ask from inside the cool hollow. Of course the trees remember. Like I said, they remember everything. Just as trees were Mama's favorite, storks were mine. I had them 6 months of the year. At the end of each summer, the storks would leave and fly to Africa, where they'd live in warmth along the Nile for the winter. In March, they would return to Poland, to the nests they had left. To invite a stork to nest, families would nail a wagon wheel to the top of a tall pole. We had one in our yard. Every March, we would celebrate when our stork returned to the nest. As August faded, the departure of the storks symbolized summer's end. 6 years ago, the day our stork left, Mama left too. She died giving birth to what would have been my younger brother. My throat tightened. I swallowed, reminding myself she wasn't really gone. I felt Mama among the trees. I could feel her touch and hear her laughter in the leaves. So I talked to the trees as I walked, hoping their branches would carry messages up to Mama and let her know what I had done. And most of all, that I would try to be brave.
Ioana. Why should we believe a cobbler? Lamented Ava. He's a shoemaker, not a prophet.
I didn't admit it, but I had begun to lose hope as well. He said he knew the area, I told her. He said when he was young he traveled by the estate with his family.
We've been walking too long. If we push much farther, the horse will be broken and won't be able to continue tomorrow.
Ava was right. We had spotted a small barn a few kilometers back. Some left the group to spend the night. We had decided to press on, following the shoe poet and his ambitious walking stick. Only one horse remained. A few days prior, we had 2 carts and 3 horses, but some German soldiers we had encountered had taken one of the wagons and 2 horses, claiming they were needed for the war effort. Since they did not ask for our evacuation orders, we didn't argue. The German army had taken everything. Cars, petrol, radios, animals, food. It was clear that they were sinking under the weight of the Allied forces. But Hitler's regional leader, Gauleiter Koch, refused to allow civilians to evacuate. Rather than fall into the brutal hands of Russian marauders, some people defied the Reich and left without orders. Like us. If Poet's estate did exist, it was sure to be a shell of its former self, stripped and plundered by the German army. Or worse, German soldiers could be staying in the house themselves. They might question us for not having formal evacuation orders.
The snow will fall soon, said Ingrid quietly.
The shoe poet stopped and thumped his stick against the icy road.
Aha! This is it!
It was nothing. We were stopped near the same pine forest we had been trekking alongside for hours. Poet called to the wandering boy and whispered in his ear, pointing into the woods. The boy took off running. We waited, shivering.
My dear Ava, if I'm right, and there is in fact an estate, will you apologize to me?
Asked the shoe poet.
If there's an estate, I'll dance with you, old man,
snapped Ava.
A close dance, the shoe poet nodded. A waltz, please.
The wandering boy suddenly appeared on the road in front of us. His tiny body bounced up and down with excitement, and he waved us forward. He stood amidst a small gap in the trees, revealing a narrow, overgrown drive.
Very smart. The noble Junkers have concealed their drive, said Poet. Move those large branches away, my boy. We must steer the horse and cart behind the trees.
The boy did as instructed. We pushed through the small opening, and the path widened into a larger mouth. Once we were all inside the brush, the shoe poet and the boy replaced the branches. Should we cover our tracks leading into the trees? I asked.
Forget about that, Ava called out. The snow will cover our tracks. Hurry!
We plodded down the narrow band, the trees soldiering up around us, dark and tall. We arrived at a clearing. In the distance, perched on a low rise, was an elegant, stately home, with long windows and multiple chimneys.
Well, I'll be damned, whispered Ava.
Florian. I paused, eating snow for a drink of water. I pulled out my small notebook and looked at the map I had sketched earlier, trying to orient myself. I had to be closer to the coast, didn't I? Once we reached the lagoon, I would cross the ice to the boats on the other side. Should I have stayed with the group from the barn? By walking through the woods, had I accidentally moved farther from my destination? If so, I might be walking directly toward the Russians. The back of my neck ached. The fever had returned. I pulled the remainder of the sausage from my pocket and prepared to shove it all in my mouth. The Polish girl plopped down in the snow and ate handfuls. I wished she'd leave me alone. But then I thought of my sister. I took out my knife and cut the sausage in half. I whistled to the girl and tossed a piece of sausage to her. She caught it and smiled. Cupping it in her small gloves, she raised it to her nose before popping it in her mouth.
Your home is here? East Prussia? She asked. You speak like East Prussian.
The pink in her cheeks matched her hat. I knew where her home was, and I knew what had happened there. Did she know? Yes, East Prussia, Königsberg, I said. I probably could have told her the truth. I was actually from Tilsit, just northeast of Königsberg. I wondered if the Russians had taken Tilsit yet. And what would become of East Prussia? It was a former German kingdom, perched south of Lithuania and north of Poland on the Baltic Sea. Stalin had already taken Lithuania. he would take East Prussia too. The girl chewed, her gaze at me unbroken.
Heil Hitler?
She asked quietly. I said nothing. The girl looked up at the sky. She pointed and started talking about the trees and the stars. I would abandon her tonight.
Alfred. Anxiety swelled in the harbor with each minute that passed. Rumors circulated that the German front had fallen 2 weeks ago. Temporary, I assured my fellow sailors. We were told the Russian forces had restored their medieval military order of rape and pillage. And now, the vile Russians were closing in. Refugees, weary souls displaced from their homes, would throng toward the port, desperate to flee the communists. There would be hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of them. The German high command had quickly organized a massive water evacuation. They called it Operation Hannibal, after one of the greatest military strategists in history. An enormous convoy of ships would be dispatched to the west. Ambulance trains loaded with wounded German soldiers barreled toward the ports. Goya, Ubena, Robert Ley, Urundi, General von Steuben, Hansa, Pretoria, Kap Arkona, Deutschland, and Wilhelm Gustloff. Ships all designated for evacuation from various ports. This would be my first ever journey at sea. My maiden voyage had already presented its challenges. I noticed an unbecoming rash had appeared on my hands and in my armpits. I blamed the communists. The sailors continued to speak of evacuation plans. I sensed my input was needed. There is not enough time, I remarked to one of my superiors. To register and board hundreds of thousands within a matter of days, I don't think it's possible, sir. You will make it possible, was the order. I looked across the dock, imagining the scene. The entire population would be driven to the coast. The ports would be mayhem. German soldiers would have priority, of course. Desperate refugees would be selected, registered, and processed to board the ships. Thousands had already arrived in ox-driven carts piled high with their belongings. They were haggard, falling asleep in the snow. I saw a man so hungry he was eating a candle. Please, sailor, help me. They would plead as I walked by. I would do something this time. Maybe. For some. I sang my melodious list of enemies. You go, Slav. I imagined myself home in Heidelberg when the war was over. Crowds of women and children would flock around me while I doled out oranges from burlap sacks. Yes, Hannelore, it is dangerous. I have been selected for a very important mission to disinfect this land. But we heroes eat danger atop our porridge for breakfast. It is nothing, dear one. Nothing. If the evacuation failed and the ports were bombed, more than 500,000 people would die. A thundering boom echoed near the water. Someone screamed, desperate, panicked, strangled with fear. My fingers twitched. A tingle ran up my spine.
Amelia. The Prussian knight walked ahead. He had secrets. I had secrets, too. My legs ached, tired of walking. I missed school. I loved my desk, my teachers, the smell of freshly sharpened pencils waiting patiently in their box. I had arrived at school that day, anxious for the math exam. Mama used to tease that I was all nature and numbers, like my father. As I approached the schoolyard, I saw it. Our desks and chairs were stacked in the back of an open truck. our textbooks smoldering in a heap. One of my teachers ran toward me, crying. "Hurry, Amelia. Go home. They've shut down the school." "But why?" I asked her, moving closer to the truck. "Wait, I have things in my desk." "No, run home, Amelia," she sobbed, tears streaming down her face. The Nazis claimed I didn't need an education. Polish schools were closed. Our desks and equipment were taken to Germany. Would a German girl open my desk and find my treasures inside? The Nazis said the people of Poland would become serfs to the Germans. They thought we only needed to count and write our name. My father was part of the Lvov School of Mathematics. He would never agree with children not being taught reading, writing, and arithmetic. They had burned our books in the Polish language. But I had learned to read very young. They could never take that away from me. I continued walking, thinking of food, rest, a soft bed, and a warm blanket. I would settle for hay and a potato. Snow was falling, making everything appear fresh. The white snow covered the dark truth, pressed white linen over a scarred table, a crisp, clean sheet over a stained mattress. Nature. That was something the war couldn't take from me either. The Nazis couldn't stop the wind and the snow. The Russians couldn't take the sun or the stars. I dropped back slightly and stepped into the trees, thinking I would feel better if I relieved myself. The night continued walking. I was crouched on my heels when I saw it. A uniformed soldier slipped out of the trees behind the night. He had a gun. He was pointing it. I jumped up and screamed. Bang!
Florian. Bang! I saw the girl first, legs apart, gun drawn. Then I saw the soldier between us, writhing on the ground, a bullet torn through the shoulder of his coat. His pistol lifted, but I shot first. The gunshots bounced hollow in my head. I scanned the woods. Were there more? I kicked the pistol away from the soldier and quickly fleeced him of his ammunition, food, papers, and canteen. This was bad. Very bad. "What's wrong with you?" I whispered to the Polish girl. "He was German, not Russian." I looked around quickly. "Hurry. Someone heard those shots." I piled up the supplies. "We have to run. Put these in your pockets." I held out the items to the girl. But the girl didn't respond. She stood, cemented in shock, pink gloves on the gun, her body trembling. The Russian pistol fell from her hand and dropped into the snow.
Joanna. We marched up the hill toward the estate. Tonight we would have thick walls, a warm fire, and a solid roof to shield us from the snow.
"Just as I remember it," said the shoe poet. "Extraordinary! We shall walk around back. I expect that's where the kitchen entrance will be."
I painted a visual for Ingrid. It's beige sandstone. Large tall windows across the front and upstairs. The entry door sits in a diamond-shaped alcove. Ingrid clutched my arm.
"I don't like it," she whispered.
"What's not to like? It's shelter." Ingrid's nostrils pulled at the surrounding air, but she did not reply. We made our way around the back of the manor house and entered through a snow-covered garden hedge. Poet's feet stopped short. Tall glass doors with shattered panes stood open into the garden, torn damask curtains flapping like a loose tongue in the wind. The courtyard was littered with clothing, broken crockery, shoes, books,
and various personal items. A baby carriage lay mangled on its side, dusted with snow. The wandering boy stepped in close. I put my arm around him.
"Sorry, but what did we expect?" Ava laughed. "Servants waiting outside in a receiving line?"
She shrugged and walked inside. Ava was right. Nothing was intact anymore. The entire region was broken, bombed, and looted. How could we have expected anything different? The cold wind blew, banging the crippled doors as we went inside. The main floor of the house was divided into 5 large rooms with high ceilings, all connected by tall double doors. Standing in what had been the garden library, we could look through the door and see across to the opposite end of the house. Floor-to-ceiling shelves lined the library walls. The books, raped and rummaged of their dignity, lay in heaps on the floor. We stepped over the books and through the doorway.
"Let's choose a room to sleep in, close off the doors, and start a fire to warm up the space," commanded Ava.
She stopped midway through the house.
"This'll do."
"Where is the kitchen?" I asked. "Maybe there is food or drink?"
"Yes,"
Ava sighed.
"A drink."
Ava instructed the shoe poet to collect any wood or paper he could find for the fireplace. "Not the books, please, poet," I whispered. He nodded and patted my arm.
"We won't disturb their things."
I set down my bag and walked through the house, admiring the ravaged, ghostly splendor of each room in its panicked disarray. I reached the end of the main floor, the dining room, and saw a small silhouette. The wandering boy stood next to the long dining room table, his head bowed by an overturned chair. I approached quietly and looked over his shoulder. A basket of mossy bread in the center of the table was crawling with brown mice. Flowered china bowls skinned with half-eaten soup sat on a dusty tablecloth, the spoons still in them. They hadn't even been able to finish their dinner.
Florian. I dragged the dead German into a wooded thicket and covered him with snow. But what if someone found him? I gripped my pistol and searched through the trees for light. Using the scent of fire as a guide, I walked quickly through the forest. I should have known. It had been too quiet today. The Polish girl saw the gun and thought he was going to shoot. She thought she was defending me. The girl followed. When I looked to the right, I heard her breathing stop, trying to swallow the tears. My sister, Annie, did the same thing the day my father sent her away up north. She did not want to cry. She held her breath in one hand and her suitcase in the other. The memory brought pain to my stitched wound. I still smelled smoke and hoped it signaled a resting spot. If I couldn't rest, I wouldn't get far tomorrow. We emerged from the woods. The Polish girl pointed. In the distance, a large manor house sat on a loaf of frozen earth. The house was dark, but smoke coughed from one of the center chimneys, grayer than the gray sky. Was it a trap? The frozen meadow leading to the warm house could be a minefield. The girl moved close. I shared her concern. What if the house was nested with Germans or Russians? Either would be a problem. The Russians would kill me or take me hostage. The Germans would demand to know why I wasn't in uniform. I didn't want to imagine what they would do to the girl. "We'll follow the tree line until we're closer," I whispered. "We'll see who's there." One thing I knew for sure. We would not find a kindly old couple enjoying an evening pipe and needlepoint in the drawing room.
Amelia. We walked toward the large house. With each step, I felt increasingly ill. I shot him. I shot a man. The knight saved me, and now I had saved the knight. Why didn't that make me feel better? The sound of gunfire had ripped a seam in my mind. Discarded memories were now leaking, dripping through. Boots, screaming, glass shattering, guns firing, skull against wood. I tried to push them away. Please go away. I couldn't make them stop. The memories rolled at me, faster, faster. All the little duckies with their heads in the water. Heads in the water. All the little duckies with their heads in the water. Oh, such sweet little duckies. A searing pain tore through my body, and I collapsed in the snow.
Joanna. The shoe poet sat by the glowing fireplace, polishing his boots with lamp black he had scraped from the hearth. The wandering boy watched intently at his side, mimicking the strokes on his own small ankle boots. The fire cracked and popped, rolling waves of heat in front of my face. Glorious. I wrapped the scarf around my head and buttoned my coat. If I can find an oak tree, I can boil the bark to treat some of the blisters, I told Poet.
I'll come with you, he said.
Rest. You'll need your strength for the days ahead.
I'm fit as a lad, my dear girl.
He pulled up the leg of his wool trousers to reveal his bony knee. It was covered in white.
Shoemaker's secret, he whispered to the wandering boy. There's mercury in white shoe polish. Fights off the arthritis. Fit as a lad, I am.
The wandering boy pulled up his pant leg to inspect his own tiny knee. Poet smiled and patted the boy's head. The old man was still full of energy. He refused to buckle under the burden of grief and loss.
Be careful out there, Joanna, he told me.
I walked through the darkened shell, back to the library with its smashed glass doors. A book lay open, its pages flipping in the icy wind. I bent to pick it up, and the name on the cover daggered me with guilt. Charles Dickens. Grandma had given the Pickwick Papers to both Lena and me for Christmas. Lena. What had I done? I set the book on a table and walked out into the cold, making my way toward the trees. Two dark figures sat in the snow, halfway between the forest and the estate. I looked closely and saw blonde braids blowing beneath a pink hat. It was the Polish girl and the young man with the shrapnel. I made my way toward them.
Were you following us?
I called out.
Hurry, he shouted. Something's happened to her.
I ran. Amelia sat in the snow, her chin dropped to her chest.
What's wrong?
I asked her. She didn't respond.
I think she's in shock. She shot a soldier in the woods. She won't move, he said.
I knelt beside her. She quickly wrapped her arms around her body, trying to inch away from me. It's okay, Amelia. Tell me what's wrong. Let me help you, I said. Let's go inside. She wouldn't move. Instead, she lay down in the snow and started to unbutton her coat. I helped her with the buttons, then sifted through her many layers of clothing. I gasped when I saw it. Oh, dear God.
Florian. We brought her into the house. My stomach pushed up into my throat. The Polish girl was my sister's age. What had human beings become? Did war make us evil, or just activate an evil already lurking within us? The day was a loss. I had left ahead of the group, yet they had arrived before me. Pathetic. My senses were so misaligned that I was nearly killed in the woods. And now the 15-year-old kid who saved my life was probably going to die. The pretty nurse tended to the girl, whispering. I watched her. After several minutes, the nurse appeared at my side. Her fingers grazed my shoulder. Come away from the fire, she said. I'm cold. You're cold because you have a fever. Come away from the fire. She led me past the man they all called the shoe poet. He and a small boy were in their stocking feet. Their boots, arranged in a row against the wall, shone to mirrored perfection. The little boy waved at me.
Hello, I'm Klaus, he announced.
I gave him a discreet wink. He smiled.
Sit down here, said the nurse.
I felt uncomfortable with her, yet somehow relieved she was there. What did you say your name was? I asked her.
Joanna.
What did you say yours was? I opened my mouth, but caught myself. A hint of a smile pulled at her lips. Was she laughing at me? Would she still be laughing when she realized that I had taken something from her suitcase?
I want to see the stitches. Take off your shirt, she said.
Inappropriate jokes ran through my mind. But she wasn't looking at me. Her eyes were fixed on the Polish girl, and the fold between her brow deepened. Will she make it? I said, unbuttoning my shirt. I wished I hadn't asked. I couldn't afford to care about the girl. She was just another tragedy of war. The nurse turned to me.
Since her survival depends on you, let's see how you're doing.
She carefully peeled back my bandage.
Not as bad as I expected.
I can't take care of her. I'm already behind schedule. She knelt in front of me. I could barely hear her.
The Russians have this region surrounded, she said. There are only two escape routes, through the port at Gotenhafen or the port at Pillau. We're all headed the same way. It will be safer if we travel together.
Her cold fingers whispered across my chest as she buttoned my shirt. She had no idea. It wasn't safer for anyone to be with me.
Joanna.
He's cute, said Ava, stretching her mammoth feet by the fire.
He's young.
Too young for me, yes. But not too young for you. What is he? 19? Maybe 20? Look, he's staring at you.
I glanced over at him. He looked away. Ava's estimation of his age seemed correct. And Ingrid had been right. His eyes were gray. My record with boys was not exactly successful. I seemed to have a talent for picking the wrong ones.
But something's not right with him, said Ava. Maybe he's a spy.
Ingrid's words echoed back to me. He's a thief. Ava leaned back in a broken chair.
But even a spy can keep a girl warm, you know?
She surveyed the room.
The Nazis destroyed this place. It must have been beautiful.
I nodded. She let out a laugh.
They certainly don't trust the old Prussian nobles now, do they?
Ava was right. Prussian Junkers didn't quite blend with other Germans. Junker meant young gentleman. The Prussian aristocracy was serving in the German army, fighting for their land and titles. But some of their ideologies didn't align with Hitler's. Back in July, Prussians were involved in an assassination attempt on Hitler. The plot failed, and the Junkers were executed.
So what's wrong with the girl? Asked Ava. Exhaustion?
Or has she realized that her father won't be doing any more math? Sorry.
I shook my head. I want you to speak to her privately. I need details to try to help her. Can you do that, Ava?
Why me?
Because you understand more Polish than the rest of us.
She seems terrified, said Ava.
She probably is, I told her. She's 8 months pregnant.
Amelia, I liked the Lithuanian girl, but the towering woman called Ava spoke bad Polish and always seemed impatient. I had never seen such a tall lady. That, Ava pointed to my belly. From Nemersdorf? No, from the farm last spring, I told her. The farm? I nodded. Should I tell her? Should I explain that my father had sent me from Poland to work on a farm in East Prussia? Should I mention that the farm was owned by father's friends, the Kleists? Father had said it would be safer for me there. The Kleists had a son named August. Heat brushed my cheeks as I thought of him. Amelia? Mr. Kleist had said, pointing to a tanned boy dragging a sledge of wood. That is our oldest, August. I smiled, remembering his gorgeous face. I put my hands on my belly. I am on my way to meet August, I told her. It is the plan. Ava nodded and walked away. I lay back and thought of August, our wedding, and how we'd make a big nest for the storks above our cottage, just like the nest I had seen on top of the barn. The images were so peaceful, so perfect, that I soon fell asleep.
Alfred. Greetings, sweet Hannalora. The cold continues, and I am braving temperatures of -15. My eyelashes freeze and stick when I step outside. This climate is unsuitable for tender-skinned women, of course, so I prefer to think of you at home, soaking your stockings or drawing a bath. Today I have news to share. I am confirmed to sail on the MV Wilhelm Gustloff, the most impressive ship in the harbor. She is enormous, 208 meters long, 56 meters high, and only 8 years old. A true beauty. She was originally built for vacation cruising and has amenities I think you would enjoy, such as a pool, a formal dining room, a ballroom, and a library. But ho, let me tickle your thoughts with this. The ship even has a movie theater, a music room, a beauty salon, and a promenade deck completely enclosed in glass. Can you imagine? All of the cabins are the same, except the private luxury suite on B deck for the Führer himself. Perhaps I'll be invited to lodge in the private cabin at some point, but I must decline. Sacrifices, Laura. I am making these types of sacrifices every day, allowing others to eat from my spoon. I imagine the Gustloff was once quite pretty for leisure cruising, but the ship is now painted a chalky gray for the war effort. It once served as a hospital ship, but was most recently used as barracks for a submarine training school. No matter. She is my boat now. Yes. How fortunate I am to be a sailor of priority, taking voyage on a grand ship instead of digging tank trenches like most of the lads my age. My services are quite in demand, so I must close. I will leave you, however, with the most impressive fact of all. The capacity of the ship is 1,463, but I am told we may have as many as 2,000 on board. Imagine, my darling. Your Alfred is saving 2,000 lives.
Have you cleaned the toilets yet, Frick?
Not yet, I replied.
Florian. I sat in the corner, watching.